gracious tender, laid aside his splendor, stooping to woo, to win, to save my soul. And blood his substance, he took the form of man, revealed the hidden plan. Oh, glorious mystery, sacrifice of Calvary, and now I know thou art the great.
Welcome to another lesson from the Hamilton Church of Christ. The natural man cannot know how to please God. Man must make a change from the natural to the spiritual before he can know the things of God. In Isaiah, the 55th chapter, Isaiah says, "Seek you the Lord while he may be found. Call you upon him while he is near. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." So won't you take a moment of your time right now and listen to a portion of God's Word being taught so you can learn about God's ways and God's thoughts. Each of these lessons is available free on cassette tape. For your free copy of any of these lessons presented on this program, please contact me, Dr. N.C. Crouch, Hamilton, Texas. We're still in the 17th chapter of Acts. Last time we'd gotten into the 19th verse, and in this verse, Stephen, in his defense before the council, the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, is giving the story of the Hebrew people, and he's at the point where he's telling about how the Pharaoh in Egypt was so opposed to the Hebrews that he now was putting to death their male children. Verse 19 says, "The same dealt subtly with our kindred, and evil treated our fathers, so that they cast out their young children to the end that they might not live." Now the rule that the Pharaoh gave out was that they were to kill all the male children, and they were to let the female children live. So this would really rob the nation of leadership. It would put them in a true state of slavery and poverty, and that's what he wanted for the Hebrew nation. However, the Pharaoh didn't realize that God had other plans for this nation. This actually was God's people. They were not a true nation at this time, but God was going to formulate them into a nation. He was going to give them a birth so that they would be a nation, and he would guide and guard and direct them as they went from this infant state into the manhood state of a nation. But at this point, it looks like from the standpoint of the Pharaoh and from the standpoint of the world that they're really going to have a difficult time even to survive as a people because all the male children are now to be put to death. Well, that's the circumstance into which Moses was born. That's the condition his people were in. That's the condition the nation of Egypt was in as it opposed his people at the time he was born. So verse 20 says, in which time Moses was born. He was born during this time of great oppression. His people were mere slaves. They didn't even have the power to keep their own male children alive. And he further says in verse 20, and was exceeding fair. Now this phrase, exceeding fair, means that he was a handsome child or a very beautiful child. A child that would be very striking in appearance. And of course, if this were the case, then he would be the one most apt to take the eye of someone who wanted to save one of these little children. So he was exceeding fair and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. Now in the second chapter of Exodus, the first few verses of that chapter, this story is given. He was hidden in his parents' house for 3 months. And then after that 3 month period, when they could no longer hide him, they built a little ark or boat and put it in the river among the bulrushes, and they cleverly planted this so that the Pharaoh's daughter would find it. So he was hidden in his father's house for 3 months, nursed in his father's house 3 months, and when he was cast out, verse 21, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And of course the story goes that when Pharaoh's daughter saw this child, she was very much taken by him. She wanted to preserve him. She realized immediately that it was one of the Hebrews' children. And Moses' sister was standing watching the scene, and when she saw that Pharaoh's daughter wanted to preserve the baby, then she immediately suggested that she knew someone who would act as a nurse, which was her mother, and of course Moses' mother. So it turned out then that Moses' mother actually was the nurse of the baby. Pharaoh's daughter paid her to take care of him, so it worked out to be a very agreeable situation all around, and you can see how God is working in this. And then, when he reached a certain age, Pharaoh's daughter took him for her own son. So the last of verse 21 says, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. The word nourished actually means that she educated him. She trained him as she would at her own son. And of course this has a lot of meaning because the country of Egypt was a very highly developed country for that day and age. It was one in which many of the things that were known as advances in civilization were known among the Egyptian people. Verse 22 says, and Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and in deeds. So he was learned in all the wisdom. He was well educated in all their wisdom. And as we think about their wisdom, we see that they were highly educated in such things as astronomy. They were inclined to want to study medicine, mathematics. They also spent a lot of time in interpreting dreams. They had a very highly developed science of religion or traditional doctrine that they handed down about religion. They were well schooled in the use of the hieroglyphics, and of course their learning is spoken of several times in the scriptures. Their knowledge is also one that was recognized in the heathen world. It is known that the science was carried from Egypt to Phoenicia and from there to Greece. And many of the Grecian philosophers traveled to Egypt to gain more knowledge. One of the Grecians, known as Herodotus, frankly concedes that the Greeks got very much of their knowledge from Egypt. The Egyptians were the ones who knew how to embalm people. They were the ones who built the great pyramids. Many of those mysteries and scientific elements have not yet even been discovered about the pyramids. And so this was the atmosphere in which Moses was educated. So he was among the most educated of all people in the world at this time. We have no reason to think that Moses was backward in anything when it comes to knowing what the body of knowledge that man had accumulated had to offer. Moses had access to it, and he was educated in it. But he is also described here as being one that was mighty in words. Now, it seems from Exodus 4 and 10 that Moses was slow of speech and of a slow tongue. And when it said that he was mighty of words, It means that he was able to communicate with the Pharaoh, that he was a man that when he did say something, he could put across the idea. He had good thought content to his sentence structure and so forth, so that he was really powerful in words, and he was able to speak the things that needed to be spoken. But he was also mighty in words and in deeds. We don't know what all this includes. Many want to say that this has to do with the time when he was dealing with the Pharaoh on the part of God's people with the 10 plagues. But this seems to be a statement that describes him before the time of the 10 plagues. So he was quite an able person, well educated, good at speech, and also good with his deeds. He was able to get things done. And so we can see very easily how this background that he had was one that God allowed him to have, so that he then would be the best prepared person for the job of leading his people out of this land. Now, Moses had a great task ahead of him. It was a part of God's plan, and that task was to mold this people who were now slaves, these people who were now groveling as servants of the Egyptians, to mold them into a mighty nation. A nation that was going to not only be one that would serve God, but one that could go in and conquer the land of Canaan, the land that God intended for them to have. So Moses had a great task ahead of him. And so he needed to be well qualified, and he was. He was a man full of the knowledge that the Egyptians had to offer. Verse 23 says, "And when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel." So at the age of 40, the Old Testament doesn't really say this number 40, but there's no reason to think that Stephen is wrong here. He decided to go back and visit his brethren, the children of Israel. Here was a man who was highly affluent now. He had a lot of power in the nation. He was the king's grandson. And so it would be an act of really condescending to go back to visit these slaves. But he decided to do this. And verse 24 says, "And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian." So it came upon a situation in which an Egyptian was oppressing one of his brethren, one of the Hebrews. He saw him suffer wrong. And so Moses took the side of the Hebrew. He defended him. And in the course of action and the contention that followed, he ended up smiting the Egyptian. That is, he killed the Egyptian. He killed him and buried him. Verse 25, "For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not." That seems that Moses at this time had some kind of foreknowledge that he was to be the deliverer of this people. And he thought that his brethren understood as much about this as he did, but they didn't seem to understand at all. They didn't seem to even be inclined to want to leave Egypt. They understood not. And so verse 26 says, "And the next day he showed himself unto them as they strove, and would have set them at one again, saying, Sirs, you are brethren, why do you wrong one to another?" So we see in this verse that the next day after he had protected and saved one of his brethren from the Egyptian, and actually ended up killing the Egyptian, now he comes upon two of his brothers that are striving among themselves. This is not an Egyptian involved now. These are two Hebrews. They strove, and he would have set them at one again. In other words, Moses tried to stop this fight that they were having. He wanted to set them at one again. And there is nothing more distressing in this world than to see two persons who are supposed to be brothers, who are supposed to be serving God together, and they get entangled among themselves and get into an argument or a situation in which they're striving among themselves. It's a very sad situation to observe, and it's even a sadder situation to be involved in. Moses said, "Sirs, ye are brethren. Why do ye wrong one to another?" What a very deep and abiding principle this should be for all mankind. If we could just realize that our fellow human is actually our brother, and if we could treat each other on that basis, the basis that we should treat a fellow brother, then this would end all wars and all strife and all wrongdoings to others. This would be the great turnaround of all the world's problems right here, to just simply be able to realize that you are brethren, why wrong ye one to another? And this is especially true of those who are striving to serve the same God, who are trying to be the children of God. We certainly, in that capacity, are brethren. We certainly should not be striving one against another. We should do everything within our power to be able to get along and to be able to work harmoniously together. And that's what Moses was trying to do here. He was setting these two brethren aright, so to speak. He was trying to get them to stop striving. But we see what happened, as so often does happen in a case when one tries to help to settle an argument. Verse 27 says, "But he that did his neighbor wrong thrust him away, saying, Who made thee a ruler and a judge over us?" So he said, "It's really none of your business, Moses. Well, where do you get the power? Where do you get the authority to come in here and to try to settle our disputes, to try to rule or judge over us?" And then he lets him know that he has some power over him. He says, "Wilt thou kill me as thou didst the Egyptian yesterday?" In other words, he's telling Moses, "I know about what you did yesterday. All I have to do is to tell this to the Pharaoh to let the word out, and you're going to be a wanted man. You're going to be one who's in disfavor with your own house, with your own government. Are you going to kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday?" So we see he's blackmailing Moses, actually. "I know something about you. If you don't go and leave us alone and stop interfering in our affairs, I'm going to tell this. I'm going to let it be known that you are a murderer." Verse 29, "Then fled Moses at this saying, and was a stranger in the land of Madian," or it's also called Midian, "where he begat two sons." We learn from reading in the book of Exodus that the Pharaoh did find out about him killing this Egyptian, that he was now a wanted man, and so he had to flee. He fled the land. He went into the land of Midian, which is a land that takes in about the same territory that we refer to as the wilderness when the children of Israel were in the wilderness. It included the area of Mount Sinai. So he really was in the land that he was going to spend with his people for 40 years. And he was a stranger in the land. That is, he was a person that was looked upon as a temporary resident. It wasn't his permanent home, but he lived there for 40 years. And there he married a woman who was the daughter of a priest. And his name was Jethro. Let's remember that we're living in the time now, Moses living in the time in which God dealt with heads of families. This is the patriarchal age. And so we do not know what capacity Jethro had before God. He's referred to as a priest. And he had seven daughters. Moses married one of these daughters, and he begat two sons. The name of the woman that he married was Zipporah, and the names of the two sons were Gershom and Eliezer. This is found in Exodus chapter 18, verses 3 and 4. Verse 30, "And when 40 years were expired, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in a bush." Now, I believe in the Old Testament this is called Mount Horeb, and there's really no conflict here because Mount Sinai and Mount Horeb were two peaks that came from the same mountain base. And so it was in the very same area and very same mountain that Mount Sinai was located. He was here 40 years, so this would make Moses now 80 years old. "And there appeared to him in the wilderness an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in a bush." This is the famous story of the burning bush. And Moses was told to take off the shoes because the ground in which he stood was now holy ground. The Lord spoke to him out of this burning bush. This bush burned and didn't really consume itself. It was a fire that didn't consume the bush. There was an angel of the Lord that appeared. Now, this word angel of the Lord simply means a messenger. It can be an inanimate object. It can be any of the heavenly beings. It could even be God himself. And so there is some thought that this angel of the Lord could very well have been God Jehovah. It could also have been the Son of God, the Messiah, the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, because he actually was the one who was going to be leading this people. And so Moses has this messenger appear to him, this angel appear to him, this burning bush, which showed that it was a miraculous situation. And then God spoke to him out of this fire. Verse 31, when Moses saw it, he wondered at the sight. And as he drew near to behold it, the voice of the Lord came unto him, saying, I am the God of thy fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses trembled and durst not behold. So the voice in the bush clearly identifies himself. I am the God of thy fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Certainly Moses would have to recognize this. This in no way left any doubt as to who was speaking. This was the God. He, as a Hebrew, knew about the one God. He, as a Hebrew, knew about the history of his people, his forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so Moses trembled and durst not behold. He didn't even try to look to see any image. He was too much afraid, too much in reverence and awe to even look that direction. Then said the Lord to him, put off thy shoes from thy feet, for the place where thou standest is holy ground. Now it was a customary thing for the Jews and other people in these eastern countries to not wear shoes, even in houses sometimes, out of respect. But certainly any place that was a holy place, like a temple or a place of worship, they did not wear their shoes there. And so that's what God is telling him here. This is a holy place, and my presence makes it holy. So here we are right in the middle of a wilderness. Nothing is said about any kind of a building or any kind of a structure made by man, but God is present, and the presence of God makes it a holy place, a holy ground, he says, one in which you should take your shoes off. And so we know that any time we are in the presence of God, we truly are in a holy place. We are on holy ground, and we need to have the same reverential awe and respect for God there as we would any other place. And he further speaks to Moses and says in verse 34, I have seen the affliction of my people which is in Egypt, and I have heard their groaning, and am come down to deliver them. So God still calls them his people. Now they were his people because he had made this promise to Abraham. He had made this covenant with Abraham. And the covenant depended upon this people for its fulfillment. This was the people that was to be made the great nation. This was the people that was to inherit the land of Canaan. And it was from this people that the seed would spring forth that would bless all nations, of course, which was ultimately the Messiah. So he says, I am come down to deliver them, and now come, I will send thee into Egypt. He's letting Moses know, I've chosen you for this job. I'm going to send you into Egypt so that you can be instrumental in the delivering of my people. So in verse 35, and this is Stephen now paraphrasing the thing, he says, this Moses whom they refused, saying, who made thee a ruler and a judge, the same did God send to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel which appeared to him in the bush. Now Stephen no doubt is showing here that this had been the nature of this Hebrew people. Anytime God sent them a deliverer, they immediately wanted to reject him. They did the same to Moses. They rejected Moses at the first time, and they had to wait another 40 years. It seemed that initially Moses, had he been accepted, could have delivered them at the time that he first went among them, 40 years earlier. But now they had to wait another 40 years, and then God sends Moses in again to be the deliverer. They did this to the Messiah also. They rejected him, the one that was sent to deliver them. Rather than accepting him for what he was, they crucified him. They put him to death. They wanted to be rid of him. And they thought they were rid, but not so. He is sent by God. He is sent by God to be the deliverer. And so it was with Moses. And so God is telling Moses this. And now this is the way Stephen relates it. The same did God send to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel which appeared to him in the bush. So the commission now was given to Moses. He was to be the one that was to be the mediator, the leader of his people, and he was a type of Christ as he did this, a type of the Messiah, and that's the point Stephen's trying to get across here to this Jewish council. Well, our time has expired for this segment of our lesson, so we must close at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.
A gentle calm, sweet calm is the peace that comes from heaven above. A lovely song,
sweet song,
sweeping o'er my soul is God's great love.
To me it's
dearer than gold,
it's what can
never be told. What joy, this great joy,
there's perfect
joy in serving him, for he set me free, makes the heart to sing.
My glory
in the Savior's cross, gladly suffer loss, he's my everything. Each day
I trust
and I lean upon his promise true.
I have no
fear and no dread,
I know that
waiting ahead is joy, God's great joy. I'm happy
now
in the Lord, no matter what betides. And I have joy, for I know the Lord with me abides.
No matter
what some may say,
they cannot
take it away. What joy, this great joy,
there's perfect
joy in serving him, for he set me free, makes the heart to sing.
That's all.